Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
I think the hype of me signing the deal made other labels come sign other rappers in the city.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 168, a talk with Slim Thug. Slim is a Houston rap icon who has been at the center of his city's rap scene since he started his career in the late 1990s. He was one of the first artists on the important label Swisha House, run by our episode 62 guest Michael Watts. After years of success both on Swisha House and independently, Slim found himself at the epicenter of a Houston rap explosion, caused in no small part by his memorable performance on Mike Jones's hit, Still Tippin'. In the wake of its success, Slim signed to Interscope Records, where he worked closely with Pharrell Williams, released the album Already Platinum, and jumped on songs with Beyoncé, Gwen Stefani, and more. After his time in the majors, Slim moved back to independence and has continued to release music at a steady clip. His latest album is Hog Life Volume 4, American King. We talk with Slim via Skype from his home in Texas. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cipher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you're there, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should check out our interview with another Houston rap mainstay, Paul Wall, on episode 126. Also consider helping out the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. In September, for example, we gave you a taste of our never-released interview with DJ House Shoes, talking about his role in the Eminem biopic 8 Mile. Become a patron by October 14th at noon Eastern to get access to this month's file. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the big boss of the North, Slim Thug. You know, you have around the very beginning of your career, coming up on 20 years ago, right? 1998, 1999, right around there.
Right.
You started out doing a bunch of guest appearances, you know, some of the earliest stuff that I was able to find. And one of the biggest ones in that first year in 99 was the remix of 25 Lighters, the Michael Watts remix.
It's the Mr. Slim Thug staying out on the grind, cause shit, I got it on my mind that it's time to shine, baby.
What do you remember about putting that together?
Oh, man, really, at that time, that's all I was doing. And a lot of those remixes we was doing wasn't official. Maybe that one was, but a lot of them was just, you know, stuff that we did, like, where we'll just get the instrumental and redo, you know, whatever's hot at that time. So that's how I really started in the game, get with Michael Watts and just basically doing those type of remixes over instrumentals and, you know, just putting them through underground mixtapes to get my name out there for the most part.
Yeah. What was it about 25 Lighters, specifically that song, that made it so iconic in Houston?
Well, 25 Lighters, man, it's just the whole vibe of the song.
25 lighters on my dresser, yes sir. I got stuck at pay, pay.
We got 25 lighters on the dresser, yes sir. Got stuck at pay, pay.
DJ DMD's 1998 song 25 Lighters featuring Little Kiki and Fat Pat has been quoted or sampled in songs by rap artists from all over, including Lil Wayne, Tech N9ne, and Kendrick Lamar.
25 lighters on the dresser, yes sir. I ain't hearing that bullshit, I'm deafer than leper.
Don't wanna see kiddies die, minors on the stretcher. So what you gonna do with them 25 lighters on your dresser?
I got 25 lighters on my dresser, yes sir. Put fire to that ass, body cast on the stretcher.
It really was a good description of the vibe of Houston at the time. At the time, everything was slow. It had chopped and screwed chords, you know, 25. Well, it wasn't chopped and screwed, but it was like more sound and screw. And Kiki had that Southern, you know, slang. And, you know, he like one of the kings of the Houston slang, who started most of the Houston slangs, him and Fat Pat. So, you know, it was just so Houston that, you know, it just easily went across the whole state of Texas as a hit fast, immediately. You know, when we first heard it, we was really addicted to it.
Yeah. And when you were doing all those guest verses and remixes and stuff like that, what was your strategy for doing guest verses? If you were on a record with like someone like Rapstar.
In 1999, I'm balling out of control. Bank rolls, so slow, my big bass is on bold. I'm chasing these cash stacks like a B-Chase honey. It's the Mr. Slim Thug and I'm in love with money.
What were you thinking when they said like, hey, can I do a verse? What were you trying to get across, you know, about yourself to the audience?
As a young rapper in the music business, I just kind of wanted to get my name out there. I wanted to not only get my name out there, I was the opposite dude. Like, as when I say opposite, I mean, at that time, the south side of Houston was the main source of music for Texas. Like, everybody from the south side had record labels and they had a lot of music out. It wasn't a lot of artists from my side of town, you know, actually doing a lot. It was a few, but not a lot, like the south side. So I just kind of wanted to get my name out there and be a representative of the other side of town, you know, and break that door down where my side of town will have some type of representation.
Can you break that divide down a little bit for us? Like, I've talked to Paul Wall about it and Michael Watts about it a little bit when we had them on the show.
Yeah, basically you got DJ Screw, who's probably the king of Houston, the unofficial king of Houston. R.I.P. DJ Screw, of course, he passed back in 2000, I think it was. But at the time of him coming out, putting mixtapes, he started a whole new wave, basically, which is the Screw and the Chop wave. That's why it's, you know, Screw, because of DJ Screw. But basically by him slowing the music down, like, that was something totally different than anybody done, you know. And he kind of started his own little new little genre or wave of music where it was cool to just go and get on the mixtapes and freestyle, you know, from the top of your head, like nothing written, just go in there and just say whatever was, you know, came out as you listened to the beat. That was his creation, basically. So through that music, they was representing Southside to the fullest. And at the same time in the city, it was some guys who was at the time who was robbers, basically. They'll go out there to the south side and steal cars or rob them, you know, by gunpoint and take the rims, which was the swangers or elbows, which was the main popular rim to ride on at that time in Houston. And a lot of people, if you wasn't from Houston, you'll never get it. You'll never understand it. Or, you know, it's hard to explain. But the thing about those rims was they made them on a Cadillac. They came out in 83, 84 on a slant-back Cadillacs that came out that year. But they end up discontinuing the rim.
The elbow rims Slim is talking about here, sometimes known as swangers, pokes, or due to the years they first came out on the market, 83s or 84s, stick out 6 inches or more from the hub like a chrome teepee frame. Starting in 2009, other companies began making replicas.
So it wasn't a lot of rims like that available for you to ride on, but that was the coolest rims you could ride on at the time in Houston. So to be on that, to ride on those rims, you sort of had to have street credibility. You had to be somebody who people respected, or if you was to be riding on those rims and get caught anywhere, you know, slipping or whatever, from wherever, gas station, wherever you may be, somebody was going to try to take those rims from you. You know, it was like a big deal back in the early 90s. So, like I say, through DJ Screw, you know, people was robbing the dudes from the south side and they kind of blamed the north side on that. So that created a division in the city where, you know, they began to start saying stuff on the mixtapes, which they drop constantly. They drop a lot of mixtapes, DJ Screw did. And it'd be a lot of, you know, we don't mess with the north side. They over there stealing, they jackals, you know. So that kind of created a division in the city. And it was just like a north side, south side beef for the most part.
There are a couple cultural style differences between the north side and the south side. And one of them is you guys, the North Side, always wore blue, which you would carry on throughout your career. And the South Side was affiliated with red. Did that color division, did that have anything to do with the Bloods and Crips using those colors, or did that kind of arise separately?
It didn't have anything to do with Bloods and Crips. It wasn't about clothes either. It was more about cars. Like the culture of Houston is candy paint on cars and putting slabs together. Slab is the definition of a slab is a car that's a candy paint, got candy paint, got the rims I just told you about, has a new chrome grill on it, you know, a special grill on it, and a fifth wheel. That'd be a complete slab with music and pop trunk with neon lights in it. I know if you're not from Houston, it sounds so crazy, but that's like what the people down here call a slab.
The exact derivation of the term slab is unclear. The most common answer is that it's an acronym for slow, low, and bangin', or slow, loud, and bangin', but many say they're just called that because they're a giant slab of a car.
So that's what the color thing was. If you was from the South Side, you pretty much rode red candy paint on your car. Now, if you from the North Side, you put candy blue on your car. You know, is what it ended up becoming.
Interesting. And, you know, there was a difference in hairstyles as well. You did a very famous song about it.
Right. Also, it was the braids and fades. It was the North Side had the braids and the South Side had the fades.
Ain't no more players than you. Whether you got braids or face, cause it don't matter where you from, long as you trying to get paid.
When I come down, I be going up the north.
And when I come down, I be chucking up the south.
Switch your house and rig shop, don't stop. Body rocking in the drop, slim thug in the SG. Ride on grease, clean the block, say what I
think. Which really, I believe the braid thing came from, you know, it was a few of the robbers or whatever who had braids. So before then, I don't feel like, before they was, you know, shooting slugs and saying, like, you know, we don't mess with them dudes who got afros and braids or whatever. Like, before that, I don't feel like it was just the North Side thing, you know what I'm saying, until they kind of made it that by, you know, dissing us, you know. And then instead of us being like, man, you know what, they dissing us and, you know, and not representing that, we ended up embracing it and represented. Like, so yeah, now we got braids and yeah, we do the blue and we just kind of embrace that. And then through that, well, I kind of embraced it. I speak on myself and I begin to represent that, you know, and make that a cool thing instead of a negative thing, kind of, you know.
Was that a conscious thing on your part in terms of like, oh, we're going to try to bring the two sides of the city together?
Exactly. It wasn't my, I wouldn't give a credit to me though. I would give more of the credit to ESG. He just came home from out of jail and he was like, hey, man, he reached out to me like, hey, man, through jail, I've been hearing a lot about you. A lot of people talking about you. They say you blowing up in the game. Let's get together, do a song. And then we sat down. I forgot exactly how, but I'm going to give the credit to ESG just because I don't remember. I think it was his idea to say, let's do a song about North and South to kind of like squash the beef, you know, and through that, we put that record out. It was an instant, you know, success, especially with the radio. They was definitely trying to, you know, stop the tension. And, you know, and not only that, a lot of the people in the city was just over it, you know. So through that, it kind of calmed it down a whole lot. And you'll see more North Side, South Side artists get on the same tracks together now and, you know, do more work together. So it kind of like smoothed that out for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had an early, pretty early song in your career called We Used to Be Aces that talks about, you know, losing friends after you blew up.
I hear my grind, and when your chance didn't go down, nigga, I got mine and flipped the shit around. It still ain't no hard feelings. I still want you to get millions, but I just can't never see me and you chilling. We hit it.
That got me thinking, you really started having success when you were like 17, 18 years old. Was it tough when that happened to stay close to the people who you knew when you were just more or less a regular teenager?
Well, one thing about me is growing up, I've probably been to maybe 12 different schools, if not more. You know what I'm saying? So I'm the youngest of seven. My mother is a single mother, and she used to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, 7 to 7. So it wasn't a lot she could, you know, do to stop us or watch us for the most part. So we kind of like stayed getting in trouble and getting evicted and having to move time after time. We was like in apartments all over the city, on the north, all over the north side, rather. All of the time we had got evicted and kicked out and had to move. So before rap, I had a few friends that I had been with from day one, but not too many. Like I can say, hey, I grew up with this kid, you know, since we was kids, we was friends, you know what I'm saying? So for the most part, my friends who I still kick it with today came around that era when I was like 17, 18, and they still the same people around me who I be with every day.
Mm-hmm. So you meet up with Mike Watts, I think, at a talent show. It's a story you've told before, and joined Swisher House. Artist-wise, who was on Swisher House when you first joined up?
Yeah, when we first started, it wasn't really a lot of rappers, I would say. It was just Mike. Now, I've been a fan of Michael Watts since I was maybe 13, 14 years old. I used to buy his tapes because it was like at the local flea market where I used to live on Homestead. So I used to go buy his tapes, and it was just the music slowed and chopped up. It wasn't a lot of rappers, you know, rapping and representing the North Side before we started with them. So I would say it was me, Little Mario, and J-Dawg who went in there together in 1998. But right before us, I would say he had maybe two different other artists, Archie Lee and Lester Roy. And that was it for the most part since, you know, back then when we first started. It wasn't a lot of the Pow Wows, Chamillionaires, and Mike Jones just came, you know, years later.
Right. So what ended up making you decide to leave Swisher House? Do you remember around when that happened?
I can't remember exactly, but I would guess that it was around 2000. I think it was around 2000, 2001, where it became, Watts like to say I outgrew Swisher House, you know, because it was kind of, when we first got into it and started doing the music, I started taking it pretty serious because this was like the first time that I found something that I had passion in, also that I could get paid from. So when I began to do the music and see that I could get paid from it, then I started to work harder and take it more serious and do more, you know, music. You know, so I did a lot of music, you know, and stayed serious. But I don't think the other guys who was in there with me, who started with me, really took it as serious as I did. So I began to make a lot more money than they were, or sell more CDs, rather. You know, they wasn't really into selling the CDs like I was. They was more into just putting the freestyles out and, you know, and getting the success like that. But I was trying to actually get paper and get money off of it. So I began to sell CDs from Houston to Austin. We drove out, me and my brother Ray, drove from Houston to Austin to Dallas to San Antonio, everywhere, and began to get it in different stores and try to spread our little, our thing through all the stores. And they got to a point where we felt like we wasn't getting all our CDs. Like when we make an order, hey man, we need 2,000 CDs to send out. We start getting them too slow from Swisher House. It felt like they was slowing us down. So we decided, hey man, maybe we should just do our own thing and be in total control.
But that didn't exactly go so well. I heard a mixtape you did called The Boss Volume 1 that was pretty much entirely devoted to dissing the people who were left on Swisher House.
Until that other big bitch by the name of Big Pick, you certified garbage. You can't fuck with me, Trick.
Really ain't fine.
I'm about to make these haters retire. Get a job at McDonald's, dick suckers for high mind. Make you by the iron, lil' yo. Hating on me now, I'm hating on you, lil' hoe. Oh, don't think I forgot. Let J-Dawg slide, let Capo ride. Just another homicide, calling me begging for cash. Dope fiend ass nigga, I get dead in your ass. You should have stayed.
Right now, that was after, and the reason why the boss came is because me and Watts always been cool. He was the CEO of Switch House, and I before I left, I told him, hey man, look. By you giving me the game and showing me the business, rather, and how to make money, I will always have a loyalty to you, you know. And whenever you...
Right. You never mentioned his name on the, you know, 15 diss raps on that CD.
No. Actually, on that CD, I told Watts, I said, hey, man, because they was actually talking bad about him, too. you know, and giving him a hard time too. And I remember seeing him, and he spoke on this on a DVD on American King. He was like, hey, man, you know, they doing this or what they do. I say, man, don't even worry, Watts. I got you. I got you. Just chill out. Because after I heard them dissing me, because this is how that happened. They put out a mixtape where all of them was dissing me.
Says I'm fucking with that street fame, underground successes. You want to be my enemy, well, come double vested. Your height don't matter, your weight don't matter. I'm switching up my flow, showing my versatile stature. I hang with the hungry, exposing real phonies. They used to be my homie, they left me by my lonely. I've spoken to the youth.
You know, and that's what sparked the boss. It made me drop my own. And that was a response, rather. You know, it was after they had put a CD out dissing me and kind of tried to gather up and gang up on me. And in my career is where that's what happened when I dropped the boss. I just reacted to that. And now I wasn't, me and Watts was cool. He wasn't mentioned on none of that, especially not in no negative way. It was all positive with Watts from day one. But yeah, that's basically what happened. You know, I ended up doing the boss. And that kind of took me to a whole nother level, man. You know, controversy sells, so I made a lot of money off of that one.
I believe it. And on a personal level, it seemed like J-Dog, that seemed to be him kind of dissing you seemed to hurt the most personally.
Last but not least, talking down on the streets, it's my ace J-Dog. He finally broke the peace. Out of a mile, that's the one that hurt the worst. I'm ashamed, but I gotta let my pain disperse. My nigga, at least I used to think so. I tried to help him, but the nigga sent me on a blank road. Gave me a lot of sad stories.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
It definitely was, you know, the most hurtful. Because it's like, out of all of the other rappers, we was cool. We had a friendship. But I looked at J-Dog as somebody who I really had a good bond with. I believed in him. And for so many times in the Swisher House, when we was in Swisher House, he was like, somebody, he was just, at first it was hard to get him to focus on doing music. And Watts would be upset with him a lot of times because of the different things he was doing, like, you know, drugs or whatever that couldn't keep him focused or whatever. And Watts would be like, man, I'm tired of dealing with him. Or he was just had the hood mentality where he'll be fighting at shows or, you know, whatever it may be, you know, and Watts was just kind of getting tired of dealing with him. But I always would be like, nah, Watts, you know, let's keep him, you know, because I really believed in J-Dog from day one. And also, that's why I brought him with me to Boss Hogg, because, you know, I was like, man, you know, I got your back, bro. You know, I know you going through stuff or whatever. And, you know, but at the end of the day, I believed in his talent from day one.
Wow. And one thing I didn't know, it makes sense that you would have some antagonism toward people who used to be on your label and used to perform with. But there are some attacks on Lil Flip on there too.
Why Flip calling himself the boss? I don't understand that either. You know what I'm saying? I don't understand the guy. You know, first it was like he the leprechaun, then he the king of the South. Then, you know, all this other shit. Now he say he the boss. You know, I don't understand that shit. It ain't real to me, you know what I'm saying? Niggas know Slim Thug been the boss from motherfucking day one.
Lil Flip is a Houston rapper from the Southside neighborhood of Cloverland. While he is best known for his hit Game Over, he also dressed as the Lucky Charms mascot for the cover of his album The Leprechaun.
Looked up with Game Over, had the whole country fooled, thinking you was a soldier. Screwed up click what you claim to help you get you some fame. When SUC say they members, they don't mention your name. You're lame.
How did that happen?
That's actually a different CD, maybe, that off of the Lil Flip one. That was the Boss Basics. Well, back in the day, man, we had our little fallout or whatever. It was over some song he put out or whatever. I felt like he was talking to me about it, talking about me on the song.
Ever since 1999, I had diamonds in my grill. You just rapping, that ain't platinum, homie. You need to chill. Cause you embarrassing Texas, nigga, you ain't real. Nigga, you been on my dick way before you got your deal. These rappers.
There are two specific explanations for this beef. The first being that on Houston legend Zero's 2005 track From the South, Lil Flip's verse, as heard here, is clearly aimed at Slim, with Platinum being a reference to Slim's 2005 album, Already Platinum. Flip also later referred to himself as the boss on Chingy's 2006 track Balla Baby Remix, which provoked Slim as well.
It ain't nothing to a boss. That's why I spent 300 on the cross.
And then I got into it with a couple of his artists. So, you know, at that point, you know, I just kind of was just you know, whatever, like, you know, I couldn't be scared, you know what I'm saying? So at that point, you know, I just kind of said how I felt and felt at the time. But at the, you know, to this day, man, I ain't, all that's dead, you know, I put all that behind me. But at that point, you know, I was just ready for whatever, young and ready for whatever, you know, whoever was trying to go against me, I was just, you know, whatever. It's, you know, it wouldn't, I wasn't scared. I had to let them know I wasn't scared.
So all those tensions with Swisha House, with Lil Flip, with Squad Up, who, you know, he was teamed up with at that point, all those kind of resolved themselves eventually?
Right, exactly. I mean, me and Lil Flip just recently kind of like, you know, just spoke and shook, you know, like at the end of the day, I don't have no issues with nobody I had back then. You know, we kind of got over it. It wasn't no real issues anyway. It was just some mainly people trying to, you know, trying to be the best in the city, or, you know, trying to, you know, see who the best in the city kind of, you know. So it was just some music stuff. It wasn't nothing, you know, personal or nothing.
Now, your very first tape, solo tape, that got a lot of attention was I Represent This.
Back on the scene, baby. Slim Thug. Back on the scene. Watching screens in my drop. Riding on swings, cause ain't no 20-inch chop. I'm breaking out boppers with the turn on my stern. These hoes gon' learn. I vote. Burn.
Yeah, that's my first mixtape. Yes, sir.
What do you remember about making that project?
Man, it really, the project consisted of a lot of the freestyles that I had already put out that was successful from the day I started in 1998. Like, I had a lot of songs that popped off back then, like some of my best work, even Still Tipping, came from a freestyle I did back in like 98.
Now look who creeping, look who crawling, look who balling in the mix. The six, long dicks, them nigga be sticking your chick. When I'm flipping, I'm grain gripping, smoking, dipping, steel, sir, pint zipping, you're tipping, on Fofo, wrapped in Fofo, pimping, four hoes, and I'm packing Fofo, way pimping on Fofo. Now look who creeping, look who crawling, still balling in the mix. It's that 6'6 long dick, slim nigga sticking your chick. Pulling tricks, looking slick at all times when I'm flipping. Bar sipping, car dipping, Grant Wood grain gripping, still tipping on.
You know, the whole verse pretty much and the chorus, you know. So
right, the fuck that or whatever.
It's like through that I put all those on I Represent This and added a few new ones. And as I first started and had CDs from and tapes from Michael Watts, you know, that was one thing. You'll make money off of that, you know, you'll do good. But when you drop a solo and you really, the whole market is yours and everything that's sold from that solo mixtape is split with you, you know, instead of dividing it between a whole group of probably 8 to 10 people with different stores and different locations. Like, it definitely took me money-wise to another level. And it definitely took my career to the next level also after I dropped it. It gave me a lot of recognition down here, down south.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the best known song on that is I'm a Ho, the one that you talked about would freestyle, the one that would, you know, become or, you know, turn into
right,
Still Tipping.
Exactly.
When you came up with that verse, did you have any idea that like, hey, this is something special, or was it only when it was repurposed that you heard it that way?
Well, actually, I don't think that was my most successful freestyle at the time. Maybe one of the Kappa freestyles was the most, or Peep the Picture, this freestyle I did over R. Kelly beat at back in the day.
Drove by the pint. Hit it to the Kappa and the boss top down. Slim Thug about to climb when I hit that G-time. If you love me, you gon' smile if you...
Still peeping the picture from when I first got with you. It took a while to get you, but paid off when I hit you. See, I sent you in my riding glide like Bunny and Clyde. We get richer side by side, but you fought for my bride. I can't deny that I'm a player.
But I always did like that record. I always did have a personal liking to that record. So later on, we had we put the chorus. You know, I had the idea of putting the chorus, making the chorus tipping on fofos and looping that. And then it was to a totally different beat, though. And, you know, since when I did the chorus like that, I kind of went back and I did this a few times with my freestyles where I went back and made a song out of my freestyles. So I did. I took a lot of the quotes from the previous freestyle and made it a verse for Still Tipping. I believe when they changed the actual beat and made it with the violins. And that's what really made the song a success to me. You know, it really gave that laid back Texas, you know, vibe to the whole world. And they could really understand that from that point. And also, I believe that my actual verse and chorus was actually slowed down a little bit. So it was kind of screwed on Still Tipping.
I was going to ask about that. So much of that stuff, you know, I represent this in a bunch of your early stuff. It's not like there's the slowed down version and the regular version, right? It's all slow.
Right.
I guess hearing your voice slowed down so much, did that change anything about the way you rap?
Actually, it was weird, honestly. Okay, because I'm a teenage kid at the time when I first started. So at some point, my voice actually changed, you know, and not only my voice, but my flow changed. And when I first started, I rapped more fast. And when they slowed it down, I had the deeper voice. But at some point, you know, as I grew into a man, my voice became super deep. And then, you know, so it kind of sounded like it's already slowed down and got that bass in it like it used to have after the effect was put on it, you know, for the most part. And my flow became slower, you know, too. So, you know, because I know people was used to hearing me rap a certain type of way. But when I was screwed and when they were screwing me down, my flow was a lot faster, you know, so it matched up. But as they stopped listening to Screw so much and I started making regular songs, I started to slow it down eventually. At first, in the teens, when I first started with the first songs, I still had that fast rap vibe. But later on, I began to slow my flow down and voice got deeper.
Yeah. And, you know, one last thing about I Represent This. There's a really powerful song in there called I Got 25 about a cousin of yours who was doing, you know, was in jail for, had a 25-year sentence.
After this flow, I'ma write my killer left. He gon' have to strive. Ho ass judge gave my cousin 25. Really, really chaps my heart. I hope white boys stay alive on it.
What was the story behind that?
Man, that was like around that time, I used to ride with him every single day, and we lived off Homestead, and basically it was like summertime. So, you know, I just kicked it with him every day, and we used to just ride around. I was smoking at that time. I remember smoking and everything and going to buy clubs and parking lots, and, you know, because it was all in the neighborhood. They had clubs right down the street on Homestead. I ain't gonna lie, he'll have me in different crack houses, all kind of stuff, just, you know, because that was just like, what we did around that time, like not me personally, because I was still a kid, but what everybody around me did, from, you know, my older brothers to my older cousins. And, you know, I was more of the one that was kind of like them. You know, I wasn't the one that was a mama's boy, always around my mama or stuff like that. Like, you know, I was more exposed to that type of life. So, you know, basically, it was a fluke thing that happened to him. Somebody owed him some money, a dude who smoked crack at the time. And, you know, his wife didn't know that I'm sure she knew, but he went in there to try to get his money into the house or whatever. I don't know if he beat the dude up or what, but he took a VCR or something, you know, to get his money back. And his wife ended up calling the police, and it was aggravated robbery, and he's just now getting home maybe, what, three, 4 years ago, if that long ago, you know what I'm saying? And he missed everything, like from the Still Tipping days to everything. He's just getting home maybe 3 to 4 years ago, and it's crazy, you know, to just get back to, you know, living life. It's crazy.
Wow. You know, you obviously had a period where, you know, brief period where you weren't independent, where you were on a major with Already Platinum. You were on Interscope.
Right.
Already Platinum is a very good record, but it doesn't sound like almost anything else you've ever done.
Exactly.
I don't take them out to eat. I ain't here to trick or treat. I ain't trying to fix your weave. I ain't heard of that. I'm just here to train hoes. Put them on the main road. Teach them how to change clothes. I know you heard that.
From the hood, living good, so I'm capping. I ain't got my plaque in, but I'm already platinum. Man, I'm already platinum. Man, I'm already platinum.
And I guess there was this weird thing that happened where at the height of the Houston rap craze, just because of how stuff worked out, you ended up, as a Houston artist, releasing an album musically that really didn't sound like it was from the city. From your perspective, what was that whole thing like?
That's exactly what happened, basically. It was, I think that the hype of me signing a deal, because I signed a deal first, I think the hype of me signing a deal made other labels come sign other rappers in the city at that time. And because everybody was getting deals. Everybody I know was getting deals. Like, and not only that, I believe that the guys over there at Asylum, after they signed Mike Jones and they had the Still Tipping record, they took that record to a whole nother level and made Houston become, made people open their ears to the culture in the city of Houston through that record. They did a good job promoting it. I think they had help maybe even from Interscope and, whoever else was getting a deal at that time, you know, because it was a good look for everybody. So that record being a major success, but I was already maybe 9-10 months having a deal, already almost done with the already platinum. So before then, the Houston sound wasn't going no further than Houston, Texas, I would say. You know, it has a small following out throughout the country, but for the most part, the main base was Texas. But now, after Still Tipping pops, people are more open to hearing the Houston sound and the Houston culture.
Right, and you're already 3/4 of the way through making an album.
Right, I'm already done with this album for the most part, and now they finally accepting the Houston sound. And at the same time, I'm working with Mr. Lee, who is the Houston sound too.
B-Roy, Mr. Lee Williams, is a Houston-based producer who has worked with Texas artists like Slim, Scarface, UGK, Z-Ro, Little Kiki, Trey the Truth, and many more.
So I had some records on there, but after my album got bootlegged, I had to rush in there with Pharrell and do more records.
Already Platinum was originally scheduled to be released in February 2005. However, the album was heavily bootlegged, so as Slim mentions here, he had to go back and add new songs. The reworked album was released that July.
So we ended up putting more Star Trek records than we were supposed to put. So it really made it sound like it wasn't what the Houston sound was, you know. So, but at the same time, honestly, that's like probably my favorite album. You know, I love that album. It go back and forth. That and Boss of Our Bosses, because Boss of Our Bosses is a Houston record. It's kind of like what I should have dropped at that point when we dropped the other records. It would have been perfect for that time.
Right.
And then I could have dropped Already Platinum after that, taking it to another level, you know.
Yeah. And different producers, there are two producers, you actually just mentioned both of them, that I wanted to ask about. As far as Pharrell, you worked with him. He's one of, obviously, the best known hip hop producers, and you worked with him kind of at the peak of his career as a beat maker in some ways.
Right.
What was it like to be in the studio with him at that point?
Man, it was the best time I had recording a record so far. And, you know, it's just Pharrell, one of those dudes who got so much talent and can open your mind up to a whole lot of new worlds, you know, not only just in the studio, but outside the studio with just conversating with him. It'll be a conversation we'll have, and he'll dig stuff out of my slang and say, oh, that sounds crazy. What does that mean? Let's do a song about this, you know, stuff like that. So working with Pharrell was a beautiful thing, man. I enjoyed it. I really did. It was, of course, the nicest studio. You'll have the Snoops and Justin Timberlakes and Keisha Coles and everybody recording next door. And he roamed the room with it, you know, Mariah Carey in there, all kind of stuff, man. So the actual process of making a record was a beautiful thing, man. I really enjoyed myself.
Mm-hmm. And what about Mr. Lee? What about his work you think goes well with your style of rhyming? Because you've worked with him a ton.
With 8 cars, a big house that's already laid, was already made before the major deal. I pull a Bentley out the lot and sell how that feel. We blowing purple stuff, we pouring purple stuff. We glowing from rich stuff, you can tell it be rich. It's Slim Thugger, T.I.P. and Bun B, bitch.
When I got the diamonds pressing up against the wood grain wheel. When you see a player shining, bitch, tell me how you feel.
Right, I believe that he just captures the sound that I want. Like, Lee is one of the last of the trill beat makers, I would say. You know, like, as far as who makes the sounds of how a UGK was back on Riding Dirty, and, you know, how Pimp C, how he was as a producer with the organs and you know what I'm saying, that Texas, we got our own sound, I feel like. And I feel like Mr. Lee is probably the most, he probably the best producer I know that can still create that sound with Pimp C gone, you know, and you know, that's probably our last person available who can do that type of sound like that, who can capture it right, to me, my opinion.
You know, I was listening to, I think it was on your podcast, on one of the episodes, you were talking about Houston rappers, and you said, you know, well, Houston rappers are never really into punchlines, you know, that style, even, you know, when that was a popular thing, that never really caught on over there.
Because, you know, I'm listening right now, I got a Texas music playlist I put together, and niggas back in the day in real Houston, you know, when that was out, it was all about H-Town. Niggas wasn't on that. Niggas was on some player shit, you know, just talking about real shit. They wasn't on no, let me do punchlines. No niggas did punchlines back in the day, you know what I'm saying? So I try to stick to that blueprint, you know what I'm saying?
Right. I mean, right now, it's a different world. Right now, Houston rappers, it's MCs, you know, it's the rappers who sound like, I mean, who got the mumbling, you know, just like the, who do the mumbling rap kind of. You got all kind of rappers, man, nowadays. But back in the day, in the 90s, when I came in the game in early 2000s, it was all about representing Texas and Houston culture, you know, from the, like I say, the cars, the rims and stuff like that. And that really, like, that didn't consist of the punchlines. When I grew up on a UGK, it wasn't no punchlines. It wasn't no MCs. It was, you know, it was more about saying real stuff people can relate to. It wasn't about, let me be a lyrical genius. It was, you know, maybe through Scarface. Scarface probably had the lyrical side of it where he was doing all that. But if you was listening to Lil Kiki's and, you know, Fat Pat's and the UGK's, for the most part, it was the music was about Houston culture, and it was about saying something real people can relate to. Let's make a song about, you know, such and such who passed, or, you know, and through that, it wasn't no punchline. Let me try to make the dopest lines. It was just saying real stuff. That's what made you the best artist back then, was being real. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Versus that. Yeah.
Yeah. But interestingly, you know, one of the guys you nod to a lot in your career, even just from rhyming over his beats a lot, is someone who is very lyrical, which is Jay-Z.
Right,
you
know, right.
A lot of freestyles over his beats, particularly the Blueprint record.
Back in the house, I make hits when I talk. So close your motherfucking mouth before I
pull out the chalk, man. I'm tired of talking. Ain't no love for scrubs trying to stand in my path. Try to do the born winner, number one contender. Slim's no pretender. Make sure y'all remember the takeover. This the hater makeover. If you got clicks with Slim, I suggest you stay sober. No time for.
What are your thoughts about Jay-Z as a rhymer and about the Blueprint in particular?
Man, Jay-Z is I feel like he's the king of hip hop, you know, right now, you know, just the way he came in the game, and, you know, not only through music, entrepreneurship, he just took it to a whole new level, you know, and he definitely is lyrical. And through him, I may have felt that, you know, I may have been influenced through his music, like on my freestyle days back in the day when I was, you know, I would say early 2000s and starting Boss Hog, I began to rap more lyrical style, you know, a little bit. And I was influenced by Jay-Z. So I definitely look up to him and love that style of music, you know. But at the same time, I believe when we talk about being a Texas artist, it's more important to me, you know, to be just speaking the real stuff, like, you know, stuff people can relate to versus punchlines.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying like I don't like punchline rap or nothing like that. I love it. You know, I love all kind of rap. The mumbling rap, I like that too. Like, I like all kinds of styles of rap. But I feel like being a Texas artist, I want to stay on the OG side of it. I want to stick to trying to keep the trill sound alive, stick to the chop and screw era that made me. Because it's still a lot of people who want to hear that, just like I want to hear that. That's my favorite style of rap, you know, so.
Yeah. There was this interesting project you did, Having Things, with Killer Kyleon, where you guys are mostly rapping over basically East Coast stuff. This was like 03, so there was a lot of like G-Unit and Cam'ron and stuff like that that you were rapping over.
Boys in blue, the best crew, we do what the best do. I'm rich, and so is every nigga I'm next to.
We don't play that, we'll spray that.
Take my advice, cuz you don't want it with Doug. The fofo slug or give your crooked braids a plug like Cuban Dubs.
What was the thinking behind that? Was it songs that popular at the time, or did you want to show people like, hey, I can rap over, you know, East Coast beats too? Do you remember what was going on with that project?
I would say with Having Things, it was a couple things. It was, like I say, it was, yeah, let me show I can be lyrical too. But I believe I was more influenced on the beats. If it's an East Coast beat, I probably rap, you know, more lyrical on it. And not only that, you rapping with Killer Kalion, who's a lyrical rapper. Like, he's more punchline. Like, he one of those type of rappers. So when you rapping with somebody like that or doing a project like that, you know, you begin to say, hey, man, let's do it. We on this type of vibe, you know, so. Through Having Things, it was definitely me and Kalion, and he's a punchline rapper. You know, like, he's lyrical, punchline type of rapper.
Ain't a cop can stop this.
Killer from spitting hot
I'm
shit.
I'm on a whole nother level.
Try to get you some more notches.
Rocks got the corn watch lit.
Like disco balls.
I stay in the kitchen like chefs cooking with Crisco all.
So I was just kind of, you know, in that vibe with him on that project.
Yeah. So on the business side of stuff, you've seen some really interesting trends happen over the course of your career, very close up. And one of those is, you know, even before digital, before MP3s, you had a real close look at the effect big box stores had over little, you know, what's sometimes called mom and pop record stores, because you were selling your tapes to the mom and pop record stores.
Out the trunk, right, yeah. That definitely slapped us hard, you know, because like I said, when we first started in the game, we went city to city, you know, town to town, and created a whole distribution kind of, you know, through not only through us by ourselves. Let me don't forget to mention Southwest Wholesale. When we put our independent projects, that was real albums, like the album with me and ASG we put out. That was through Southwest Wholesale, which was located in Houston, and they was a distributor. It was kind of like they could get your records all over the country or wherever you wanted them to get it, you know, and that helped us out a lot and had a lot of Houston artists doing independent records and staying independent and not signing no major deal, because that was kind of like, our outlet, you know, we can get paid right in the city and go pick up our check down the street. So that was a big blessing. But yeah, when the big stores like Best Buy's came along, and with the $9.99 albums, and the mom and pop stores just couldn't compete. I also had a store or two. I had two stores at the time, I think, and we also couldn't, you know, survive through that, because we would have to basically go get our CDs from Best Buy, you know, and
in order to keep $9.99. The prices low enough to
right. It was compete, low yeah. enough like wholesale to us. So
yeah.
Of course that killed us and a lot of the other mom and pop stores around the world. And that kind of just messed up our whole you know, outlets of getting money. So it definitely was something we had to work through, and it was a big hit for us. That's what kind of gave me the inspiration to, hey man, I might need to go and get a deal now, because that's part of the reason why I signed, because I was like, you know, the mom and pop store, how we did it, where we went and bought our own blank CDs, put the cover on it, packaged it at our houses, and distributed ourselves through Greyhound or whatever it may be. Like, we wasn't able to take advantage of that like we used to. You know, a lot of people, like, we still sold mixtapes and they still was cool, but it just was nowhere like it used to be. So we had to kind of, you know, change with the game.
Right. And, you know, after one record on Interscope, you went back to being independent. Did you change anything about the way you did business, the way you released your projects after seeing how Interscope ran their operation?
I kind of just took advantage of them, their promotion they gave me. They promoted me worldwide, you know, and I just wanted to take advantage of that and say, hey, man, you know, let me go back independent with the worldwide promotion that Interscope gave me already and benefit off of that, you know. And at the end of the day, honestly, the Boss of All Bosses project, the I Run, the Thug.
I run the streets all night and day.
The hood love thugs.
Cause I still cause I'm dressed like a thug. Fuck the dress code, we bout 100 deep, and they gon' let us in or get their ass beat. Boss hog.
Those are like my biggest records, you know what I'm saying, for the most part. Like, when I do a show, the records off of Boss of All Bosses definitely are bigger than the records I did on Interscope with Already Platinum. So, you know, from radio to sales to everything, you know, that the independent album did better, you know, as far as like, so it worked out better for me when I went back and did it my own way.
Speaking of radio, Check On It, obviously the song you did with Beyonce.
Go ahead, girl, put some back and some neck up on it. While I stand up in the background and check up on it.
Ooh, boy, you're looking like you like what you see. Won't you come over and check up on it? I'ma let you walk up on it. Ladies, let them check up on it.
Wasn't originally supposed to be a single, but the radio just kind of started playing it. And then all of a sudden they had to rush to make it a single and throw it on as a bonus cut. What do you remember about that process of first being on the radio, even though no one had, I guess probably no one told you it was going to be a single?
Right. That was super, that was just a blessing that fell out the sky for me, at least. And what happened, I had got a call from somebody from, you know, their camp or whatever, who said, hey, man, we want you to, this is the last Destiny Child show in Houston. We want you to come out and perform your verse from Still Tipping. So I did that. I showed up, performed. It went great. You know, the crowd went crazy. So after that, I got a call. I think that was a Friday or a Saturday. That Sunday, I got a call like, hey, we got to turn in this last Destiny Child album. We was wondering if you had time to do a verse, you know, before we turned it in Monday, I think it was. So I was like, sure, send me the song. So they sent me the song, which was not Check Up On It. It was another song. And I did it. I did the verse. And before I even finished that, they sent me the other one. And the other one was Check Up On It. They was like, can you do this one too? And then we'll see. So they sent me Check Up On It. I did my verse. I did two verses, actually, because Bun B wasn't on the original one. And, you know, I sent it back to them. And I was just kind of chilling and hoping they like what I sent. And eventually, I heard that it came out. They gave me, first they gave me a call and was like, you know, getting all my information. So I figured it made it. And then, you know, the city itself probably took it upon itself to start playing it, you know, because I would say 97.9 The Box is so supportive of, you know, Houston artists and especially myself. So they probably was the ones who started playing it first. Who knows? You know what I'm saying? And from day one, they've just been big supporters of my career. So, you know, that, and it took off, man, number one. So, you know, that's a blessing, like, to have a number one record with the queen of the, you know, not even just Houston, the queen of the R&B period, you know. So it was a blessing for me. You know, it just turned out right.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've had a few endorsements over the years. One of them that I thought was interesting was Sobieski Vodka, which, you know, also Bruce Willis was tied up in, famously, and even more famously, they ended up not being able to pay him, and he had to settle for 30 cents on the dollar or whatever it was. What was your situation with them?
Well, Sobieski, actually, that came from a friend of mine named Jared. He's a marketing dude out of L.A., and we still friends to this day. And basically, with video shoots, he would be, you know, the budgets was crazy back then for videos. So it was always, he would always try to come through with, you know, different products from people like the FUBUs or even the crown holders. We was a big, like, people would think that was my clothing line a lot of times. That was through Damon John, the shark now.
Who are the sharks? They're self-made millionaire and billionaire investors who are entrepreneurs themselves. Damon John is a fashion and branding expert who grew his homegrown clothing line into the globally recognized fashion brand, FUBU.
Me and him, good friends, me and Jared, like, he worked for Damon. And, you know, they would just have all kind of products. And I would tell him, hey, man, I got a video shoot. You know, what can we work on and what y'all need, you know. And they'll come out and do that and cut a check, help with the video expenses. Just, you know, cut me a check for representing the brands. So that's how that came about, you know. So it was a good thing. They showed love a lot of times and helped out.
Nice. And, you know, you have your Boss Life brand that's doing a whole bunch of stuff, clothing. I know you've even got into construction, all that kind of stuff. One of the things that I thought was unusual was you're selling e-cigars. I'd heard of e-cigarettes, but never e-cigars. How'd you get into that business?
Right, with the Boss Life brand, with our name being Boss Life, you know, bosses smoke cigars. You know, we got approached by a group from San Antonio who had the idea of, hey, man, we want to team up with y'all and do these Boss Life cigars, the e-cigars. And they brought it to one of my shows, I think at South by Southwest, and I tested it out, and it was just something cool, you know, at the time. So we definitely got involved with them and was selling e-cigars for a minute, but we stopped dealing with them. We just couldn't get on the same page with them as a company, like as far as the business side of it. We never seen eye to eye with them, you know, and we tried to make it happen for about a year, I would say. But eventually we just felt like, man, this wasn't working out. So we separated at the end.
Makes sense. And going back to Houston for a second, I was listening to your record called Houston. And on the outro of it, you know, you talk about how Houston has changed, how it doesn't feel the same to you anymore.
All from us, and that's what I love to see. I miss my city, Maine, R.I.P. Pimp C. Trying to keep it alive, feel like the thrill is gone. The city changed, Maine, don't even feel like home.
Can you go into that for a minute? What did you mean when you said that?
It's just not as much pride as it was. Like back in the day, everybody was proud to be from Houston. Everybody was proud to represent Houston culture. Now it seems like the new generations are shying away from it more and more and kind of riding the wave of what's going on everywhere. You know, it's like not just in Houston, but period, I think, in the music business. Whatever's hot right now, it's going to be like 4, 5, 6, you know, more people doing the same thing in a matter of what, weeks. It gets that fast now. It's like everybody kind of sound alike, from dressing alike, how you wear your hair. And, you know, it's just so much. I don't believe it's a lot of people being themselves. And that's what I feel like in Houston. I feel like it was influenced more from out of town rappers than it used to be. Like back in the day, we looked up to the UGKs and the Rap-A-Lot rappers, and all we wanted to do was represent Houston and, you know, represent Houston culture. Now people be like, man, we tired of hearing about this and candy paint and tired of, you know, they kind of like want to do something else on a new wave or new vibe. So that's what I'm saying when I say it don't seem like it's the same city.
And what about the city's relationship to drink, which obviously has been, you know, adopted
right
worldwide? I mean, you were talking about it when you were 17. You were saying, oh, I'm addicted to drink, like rapping about it.
Serving my bladder because I'm addicted to lean. When beams hit my pinky ring, see the glass gleam.
How has your relationship to it changed over the past like 20 years? How has the city's relationship to it changed?
Honestly, I've been stopped sipping and serve on the cool. Like, it just got too crazy. It was like, it used to be so much cheaper back in the day when we was doing it in the 90s. And, you know, it was like I say, it was like those Rams. It was something that, you know, was a Houston thing. You know, it was just something that we culturally did and we, you know, really had took pride in. But now it just got kind of crazy, man. The prices went up. I think pints nowadays maybe $3,000. Like, you know, it's like dumb now. You know, it's just, that's a stupid drug to do down. It's just don't make sense to spend that much money to get high. But, and then, you know, now everybody hyping it up, from everybody, pop stars, the rap stars, to they didn't got banned now. The real original drink that we used to sip on is banned now.
Activist, the manufacturer of the syrup, discontinued it in 2014 because of all the bad press.
And they got all kind of replicas. They got red, you know, and different. They got purples that ain't the original purple, or, you know, it's just, it ain't the same. So I'm not into it at all at this point. But, you know, it's a lot of guys in the city. A lot of people everywhere still do it, you know, but I'm just not into it anymore.
How do you think about your own legacy as a rapper? Because you have a lot of music. One thing I learned while preparing for this is you just have, you know, hours and hours of music that you've recorded and released over the years. How do you think about your own legacy as an artist? What do you think you have makes you unique that you've left behind? And ask about this specifically because
10 years after you started, you had an I Represent This Part 2. You know, it was interesting to name a project that, to kind of harken back to your very first album. So I guess start with that. Why do an I Represent This Part 2 10 years after the first one?
It was kind of like the 10-year, you know, anniversary is what I was thinking, you know. But at the end of the day, for the most part, I was just trying to keep doing what made me. You know what I'm saying? When I did I Represent 2, I wanted to keep doing underground music and never change that, because that's what really made me. That's how most people knew me. If you wasn't listening to Chopped and Screwed music from 98 to 2004, you wasn't really familiar with Slim Thug for the most part. And a lot of people out of town don't get it, don't even understand, you know, the major moves I made in the city or in Texas through Chopped and Screwed music. So a lot of people don't even understand that. But I would say, me personally, what I brought to the game was, I felt like I put the North Side on the map, and like we squashed the North Side, South Side beef, me and ESG. That's like some of the main things we did early. And then, you know, taking it to the major level, took Houston major, you know, with the Steel Tipping. And even if it was on Mike Jones' album, I kind of feel like it's my song, you know. But, you know, so that Steel Tipping thing was something that started the whole Houston movement. That was the biggest movement so far, you know, in the city, I feel like. What else? Just being a boss too, man, being independent for so long, you know, and not having to sign with a label and not having to have a label to be consistent and to still, you know, put out music that stayed Texas, you know, without no backing from, you know, majors or nobody. Just me out here grinding and putting music out and staying true to, you know, the sound that made me and the sound of my state, you know, so. That's all I want pretty much people to get from me. But not only that, though, you know, like looking at a Jay-Z or whatever, you know, on a business side of it. Now we got Boss Life Construction. We building homes, affordable homes in our old communities. We got clothing lines and, you know, we trying to do the business thing, too. We looking at guys, like I say, like Jay-Z, and learning from them and being inspired by them to do other things and use our marketing power to open up other business or whatever.
Makes sense. And so you have your, you know, Hog Life series, the last four albums you've done. The third one in that had a lot of, like, more contemporary sounding, like almost trap style beats.
Right.
I just get it in, hold up, I just get it in, fuck a bitch and a friend, hold up.
I just get it in, fuck a bitch and a friend. Talking down on the neck.
Was it different for you to rap over that than the kind of stuff you normally rhyme over?
It's not different because, like I say, I feel like I'm an underground artist, and that's where I come from, rapping over whether it's a Pharrell beat or whoever beat. I never was scared, because when you heard me on my early mixtapes, if you listen, then it was on whatever beat was hot at that time, you know, so I never was scared of rapping on whatever beat. But yeah, that definitely was the more trap album in this series. And the reason why I did that is because I knew it was going to be, I planned on doing a four album series and dropping them all in 1 year. It was just a random thing I had. I was like, man, let me feed my fans and let me drop one album each quarter, you know, and not only that, just test myself. I stay trying to test myself as an artist, as a businessman, as whatever, you know, and from working out, whatever it may be, I just want to get better. So I was like, let me drop a 4-part series in 1 year. So the first one was kind of like with my producers of today who did the Houston mixtape I put out, you know, and other stuff like that. That's Gavin and B-Dunn. So that first one was mainly them. The second one was it was Mr. Lee, the guy who I really, you know, my favorite producer of all time. And then the third one was more trap style. Like, you know, I wanted to do it where you wouldn't get tired of them, you know. And the second album was more of a freestyle album where I kind of did the 1998 where it was a lot of rap.
I'm from Texas, nigga, where they Cadillac pushes. Bitches blowing up my phone, but I'm in the kitchen cooking up the work. Still got bricks for the dirt. I be on my grind getting mine.
Like now you hear barely hear 12 out of rappers. You know, they barely rap that long. But I just wanted to do it the old school rap, you know, over a minute or two straight, you know, like that type of style on the second one. The third one, let me do some trap turn up type stuff that relate with more of the younger kids or whatever, you know, just to give them that. And on the fourth one, I wanted to do a real album in the sense of talking about real life, real stuff that you can relate to. Church. I did a song called Church featuring Joel Osteen on the second one.
If your friends are going places, have a spirit of excellence, kind, generous, courteous, then those qualities are going to rub off on you.
You gotta get these blessings. So tired of stressing. Learning new lessons. Plenty questions. It's time for testing. Never ever resting. I'ma stay grinding.
I didn't really feel like it fitted on that album, but because it was a Mr. Lee album and he the one sent me a beat, it had that vibe. It was like a gospel vibe to it. I sampled Joel Osteen on it, and that was a huge success out here. So after that was successful, I said, and it affected me differently as a rapper. A lot of people from young to old came up to me. I'm more of a rapper who talks about, man, I got this, I do this, you know, my cars, whatever. Man, I'm more flashy type of rapper, you know. But when I did Church, it was a real record. It was about real, you know, stuff people can relate to, you know what I'm saying? A lot of times I'm rapping about Rolls Royces and shit. The average person like, man, whatever, I can't relate, you know. But all right, so on Church, I just kind of kept it real and talked about real issues that people deal with. So after I got the response from different people, young, like I say, young, old, mamas, everybody calling me like, hey, man, I love this record. It touched me. It did this. And they telling me their story. I said, man, let me do an album like Church, you know, on some motivational, get better, positive, you know, just real records, you know, personal records, talking about my kids, talking about my brother I lost early this year.
I was going to say, you talk about your brother on He Will.
Right.
We miss you, bro. You was a hell of a father. Look at your daughter. Look at your son. I swear you was as real as they come. Ray Jr. still taking it hard. I told him, give it to God. We all going.
What was that like to write?
Oh, man, it was special, man. It was like, I don't really do that. I don't really get personal. I'm not an emotional person at all. Yeah, you know, and girls hate me for it, you know. But at the end of the day, I had to step out of my comfort zone and talk about it and just say some real stuff, you know. And but like I said, I did stuff like that before, like you say, off of the old freestyles back in the day. But, you know, lately I haven't did any records in that type of form. So I just, you know, dove into it, man, and kept it real. And, you know, this album here, more than I'm concerned about selling records, man, already the feedback I've been getting from different people I know, different people I see around the city. My brother, his mother calling me like, oh, I love this song. His kids loving it. You know, that's more important to me than anything, you know, just to have people at 35, maybe almost 20 years later, for people to say, man, this could be your best album. You know, that type of thing right there is what keeps me going and keep me passionate about making music, you know, even if I got to do it for free, you know. So that's where I'm at with it. And that's how I feel, man. And people around me who really know me or who just even follow me on Instagram can see that that's my growth level right now. That album is really how I feel. This is what I preach every day. If you follow me on Instagram or any social media, you'll say American King is really how Slim feeling right now. And he just motivated and on some different level. You'll see the growth from that compared to, you know, the other things I did in the past. So, you know, it's one of my favorite albums. I love it, you know. And, you know, I'm behind it 100%, man. I'm just, you know, trying to do something real. In a world full of turn up and everything else, I just want to be opposite and go my own way, have my own lane, and make music, be the Joel Osteen of the hood is what I like to call it.
Nice. And you have a podcast now, you and a couple of your friends kind of sitting, you know, talking about issues of the day. So, you know, right. getting in on our turf as podcasters. What made you decide to do that?
Oh, man. Honestly, what made me start doing a podcast is I hate that we have to go to New York to get promotion, man. Like, because I feel like when I go to New York, everybody only understands what they heard from me on a major level. And like I said, if you wasn't chopped and screwed and listening to that type of music, you ain't really familiar with who the real Slim Thug is, because that was like my golden days to me. And I want people to understand me more, not only me, but Houston artists in general. Like, I feel like it is much needed for somebody in Houston to have some type of platform, a respectable platform. Like, and we not there yet, but we building ourselves up to be a respectable platform where people from the South can come right down the street and I can talk to a rapper from out here and truly understand everything he did. Like, I go to New York and they're going to say, well, Still Tipping, like, that was the last thing I did. Like, I didn't drop an album every year and I haven't been on the radio every year in Houston since back then. You know, like, every year we dropping something independent and on the radio, not just me, the Paul Wiles, he got a swinging in the rain.
Candy painted rain dripping out the panel. It's tradition where we from, they might not understand it. Handle with care, them pokers take a pole to manage. The way I swing so eloquently is rain dancing.
That's record on the radio, and we number one on the radio still, and, you know, in this region and doing our thing. So, I just wanted to kind of give some type of platform where not only just a podcast, I want to have some type of website, a respectable website, like a Rap Radar or something, Hot New Hip Hop, where people can go for Houston music. Like, if we send out stuff to New York to Hot New Hip Hop, we might have a Hot, or they might not give us the Very Hot or whatever it may be, because they don't really understand our music. Same way, if we go to New York and we listen to that music, the local music, we probably wouldn't understand that, because it's two totally different worlds. You got people in who don't even drive cars for the most part, and then in Houston, cars is the world. If you don't have a car, you're nobody out here. You know what I'm saying? So I wouldn't expect people in New York to really get the type of music I make. So I kind of want us to have our own, you know, platform in the city of Houston where we can, well, not only Houston rappers, but even out of town rappers can come, you know, the New York rappers can come to Houston also, where we'll just have our own little thing. That's basically what the podcast is about. But at the same time, I have to admit that I kind of fell back from that in the beginning. I was like, man, let's not do it a rap podcast. Let's just talk about real situations that's going on in the world and talk about stuff that people need to hear. So, you know, I'm back and forth on it. If we want to make it a real podcast, like we had somebody who had ended up going to jail for murder and he was just in the car. You know what I'm saying? Like, we had him on there. We had a girl on there who strips, and she kind of broke down how prostitution is and why women would need a pimp.
He probably got a quota or something.
Yeah, you got a quota, but the thing about it is when you got a real pimp, you want to impress him. So when you go to work, you're embarrassed to say you made $700.
Right.
Because he's going to be like...
You know what I'm saying? And then we had a pimp on here talking about, you know, why it made sense to have, you know, a hoe or whatever, a prostitute working for you or whatever.
I'm their manager, so I handle all that. They don't have to worry about nothing but working. You take care of my business, I'm going to take care of your business. And then I'm going to legitimize it. And my whole thing, I tell any bitch, if I can't change your life immensely or show you something you hadn't seen within 45 days of fucking with me, you shouldn't fuck with me.
And, you know, it's just getting in different people's minds and telling different sides of stories that I feel like people don't hear every day. We really not that serious, though. We really just doing that for fun. That's all in fun. We just decided, hey, man, let's do a podcast. My DJ knew how to do it somehow. So we wasn't that serious. We just kind of jumped in the game and still just do it for fun for the most part. You know, it ain't really nothing. We like, oh, we want to beat y'all. You know, we're not like that.
Yeah. And obviously you and Zero, who is one of my absolute favorites. And I will say that over and over during episodes until he finally is a guest on the show.
Right. I definitely can set that up. If you send me your info, I can get him on there.
That would be great. You've been teasing a joint album with him for something like 6 years now. When can we finally expect to hear it?
Actually, man, that music been done. And through the series, I dropped a couple records off of that album. And we did way more than that. And we talked about it recently, but we're going to try to drop it around, you know, Super Bowl. So I plan on getting in the studio with him, you know, this fall and doing some fresh new records. We already have maybe 30 that's never been heard, but we want to get in there and do some fresh new records also. So, you know, hopefully we can make that happen. It didn't happen last time because he's still signed to Lil J from Rap-A-Lot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just couldn't get that together all the way. But now I think everything is rolling smooth on their end. So I think we'll be able to make it happen.
Great. And one last thing. You have a great song called Drank, where you express regret for all the money you spent on weed and drank.
I wonder last year how many sweets I roll. I wonder last year how many cups I pour. Or that muddy, muddy purple I purchased by the paint. I'm spending too much motherfucking money on this drank. Them prices so high, I got a nigga.
What else do you most regret having spent money on?
Oh, man. Honestly, I'm like known for being cheap. I'm like one of those rappers who never spend no money. I don't go to the club and make it rain. I don't buy bottles. Like, I can't remember ever spending $5,000 in the club, you know, and most rappers can't say that. But I buy a lot of cars and jewelry, and I buy stuff that I feel like I can get money back from. But at the same time, when you buy Rolls Royces, your depreciating value is a lot more than when you buying something regular. You know, like right. I might lose $75,000 on a car when I sell it, you know, and that's never good. So I would say I lost a lot of money with cars because that's like my favorite thing in the world since I was before I was rapping. I always had a fetish for cars, and I would say jewelry because, you know, once you leave out of the jewelry store, it's never worth, you know, what you pay for it, you know, especially if you're getting something custom. And I would say those two things I spent the most money on.
Right. You still have the Rolls Royce that we saw in Cribs?
This right here, why they count me the boss. Because we get money.
Nah, I got a new one. I had a few of them, man. Since then, I probably didn't have five or six. So right now, I got the new Wraith. I just got that maybe a month ago. Before that, I had the convertible drophead. I got a Bentley Flying Spur, a 14 right now, and a Wraith. And, you know, I got a few other cars like a Hellcat, new Escalade and a Camaro, and I got a Harley. But I still love cars, man. It's like my passion, you know. So, yeah, but that's definitely something I spend a lot of money on.
Awesome. And what else are you working on? We have American King out that you're obviously promoting and talking to people about. What's next?
Man, I actually, because, like I said, American King was supposed to drop and last year, and the only reason why I didn't was because my distributors felt like I was stepping on my own toes by not giving them enough time to promote, you know, and set the project up right. So I already have pretty much a whole new album done. You know, I'm kind of just not trying to flood the game. I'm going to just sit back and see if maybe I can drop it later on this year before we do the King and the Boss. And, you know, on the other side of it, man, I'm turning 36 next month. I really want to focus on new business ideas outside of the music that I can do forever. Things I can leave as a legacy for my family and, you know, things I can do where I can hand that down to my sons to take over. You know, like I really want to focus on that type of thing. And now I'm going to do music all the time just because I love doing music. Like I said, I would be doing it if it was for free. I just love doing it. But at the same time, I want to keep coming up with different ways to do. I want to step into the corporate world somehow, some way, and, you know, and figure it out, man. I just want to find my next passion for the most part.
Great. And so thanks for talking to me, man. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate you, man. Thanks for having me on, man. Appreciate that.
Houston's rap scene is endlessly fascinating to me, and examining it has given the Cypher some of our most memorable episodes. Until the scene blew up nationally in the mid to late 2000s, it really was almost its own separate ecosystem within the world of hip-hop, with its own heroes, its own record labels, and, as you heard in this episode, its own rivalries. Talking to Slim gave me real insight into all of that, as well as into what made the region unique musically. It was great to speak to someone who was there at the beginning of Swisha House and to see what it was like for someone used to selling their own tapes to suddenly deal not only with a big record company, but with the collapse of their entire distribution system. I also liked hearing how Slim got past those obstacles and managed to reinvent himself and his business in order to keep going. Join us next week when our guest will be Martha Diaz. Martha is an organizer, curator, archivist, media producer, and educator. From putting on rap concerts in Cuba to curating hip-hop film festivals, from the set of Yo MTV Raps to the campuses of the most prestigious universities, she has repped hip-hop and advanced the culture in almost every imaginable setting. She also brought along a special guest, Summer McCoy, the founder of the Mixtape Museum. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important that you give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with as little as a dollar a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Joel Osteen of the Hood.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Of course, the nicest studio.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
One of those dudes who got so much talent and can open your mind up to a whole lot of new worlds.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
We had our little fallout or whatever. It was over some song.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jay Smooth.
That was super. That was just a blessing that fell out the sky for me, at least.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Send it over now.